It is Friday, March 30th, and you're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Coming up this half hour, U.S. diplomats expelled from Russia after Washington sides with Britain on the poisoning of a former Russian spy.
The United States is one with the U.K. This is a show of solidarity. This is a commitment to our closest ally and friend.
Also ahead, Palestinian protests get underway today near the Israeli-Gaza border. Christians mark Good Friday in the Holy Land, and the sounds of Nora Jones. That's all ahead. At this moment, 60 Russians working in the U.S. are busy packing their bags and preparing to head home. In Russia, 60 Americans are doing the same thing. This week's tit-for-tat expulsions of diplomats and possibly intelligence agents between the two nations comes as the fallout from the poisoning of a Russian spy in Britain grows. Western leaders point the finger squarely at Moscow, while Putin's government accuses the West of wanting a new Cold War. To put it simply, relations between the U.S. and Russia are in the ditch. But with mutual expulsions now over, perhaps tensions may thaw a bit. VOA's Jamie Dentmer asked the U.S. ambassador to Moscow, John Huntsman, if this might be a turning point on the poisoning.
Well, it depends on how you define the end point. If the end point is Russia acting more responsibly with respect to its commitment to undertakings, agreements, and international institutions, its very presence in the United Nations on the Perm 5, for example. What is its commitment there to things like chemical weapons, where five times they voted against investigating chemical weapons abuses in Syria? So there are some broader, longer-term issues about where this goes and what a successful outcome might be. But clearly a successful outcome would be Russia that steps back from its malign activity and becomes a responsible partner.
Why did the U.S. decide to believe the British case on this? I mean, what's been publicly laid out by Theresa May is intent and capability. Is there more information, intelligence information, that's been shared with the Americans, which would indicate that there was some kind of Russian state sanctioning of the poisoning? And if there has been, should that be more widely shared to convince doubters?
Well, you don't just decide to believe. We're growing up mature democracies. We have robust civil society. We're open, transparent countries, both the United States and the UK. So it's not like you can conduct an investigation without a lot of very interested and probing eyes following the case the entire way. So that's the environment in which we're operating. Straight up professional. The burden is on the UK to look at the case, to investigate it, and to come up with their results. And of course, there's been some close sharing of information. That's the way these things go with the security services. That's how you would want it to be. And you read in the papers a little bit about what is going on, and I suspect, as with in life in any democracy or transparent society, we'll learn a lot more. The citizens will learn a lot more as we go forward. I suspect that that will be the case. But the United States is one with the UK. This is a show of solidarity. This is a commitment to our closest ally and friend. And it would be saying something horrific if we were to do nothing in the face of what we do know, and given our longstanding friendship and alliance with the UK, that's not how America would want to respond.
Did the Russian officials you talked to show any surprise at the decision by the US to expel, 60 Russian diplomats, when it came so shortly after a telephone call from President Trump to President Putin congratulating him on the election?
Well, you can never stage or time things perfectly. You have to, there's a rhythm to the world, and it's not exactly predictable. And you have to use the tools that you have at your disposal in responding. I will tell you, as long as I've discussed Russia with the president, which goes back to when he sat me down and asked me to take this job, he's been very consistent about wanting to engage. notwithstanding our challenges, his desire to engage and to keep a dialogue alive and well. He's also laid it out to me in pretty plain terms that he expects any kind of engagement and meetings at the head of state level to be based on progress on the issues that matter most. Coming from the private sector, and I've worked for many presidents, Republican and Democrat, he's a results-oriented person. He wants to know where we're going, what's been done, what kind of progress, for example, on Ukraine and issues like that. He's very much into the results and where the relationship overall is heading based upon the very real and important issues we confront together.
U.S. Ambassador to Russia John Huntsman speaking with VOA's Jamie Detmer. For the record, Yulia Skripal, the daughter of the Russian spy who was poisoned, continues to mend. The spy, Sergei Skripal, remains in critical condition. These are some of the top stories that we're following at this hour. One American has been killed among coalition personnel in an attack in Syria. A senior Afghan provincial council member has been assassinated. At least six Palestinians have been killed in a Gaza mass demonstration. And dozens have been killed and many more injured in a bus crash in Turkey. Expanded coverage on these stories and more available at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A newly found exoplanet called K2-229b is about 20% larger and 2.5 times more massive than Earth. But the international team of researchers who discovered it say it's like a supercharged version of our solar system's innermost planet, Mercury. The exoplanet, described by the scientists as hot and metallic, circles an orange K-dwarf star located about 339 light-years away in the constellation Virgo. The discovery was made by the team after analyzing data gathered by NASA's Kepler Space Telescope's K2 mission. K2-229b is said to orbit closely to its star at a distance of about 1.8 million kilometers. The dayside temperature of this tidally locked planet is said to be around 2,000 degrees Celsius, which can vaporize rock. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Non-Orthodox Christians around the world are observing Good Friday, marking the crucifixion of Jesus. Robert Berger reports for VOA on events in Jerusalem where the faithful carried out an ancient Holy Land tradition.
As you know, the negotiations, so-called peace processes.
In a tube, a concrete.
We'll have that report for you in just a moment. You are listening to VOA's International Edition, coming to you live from Washington, D.C. I'm Doug Bernard. As we mentioned earlier, non-Orthodox Christians around the world are observing Good Friday, marking the crucifixion of Jesus. Robert Berger reports for VOA on events in Jerusalem where the faithful carried out an ancient Holy Land tradition. Looks like we're still working on getting that report ready for you. Here we go. Looks like we're good. Let's hear that report from Robert Berger.
Pilgrims from around the world packed into the narrow cobblestone alleyways of the Via Dolorosa in Jerusalem's Old City to take part in the traditional Good Friday procession. Singing hymns and reading passages from the Bible, they retraced the footsteps of Jesus to the 14 stations of the cross. Gary Osterberg is from Canada.
Oh, it's an honor to be in this land like this. It's been great. It helps with my belief. It helps with my faith. It helps with everything.
In the Holy Land, religion and politics are never far apart. The Easter holidays come 6 weeks before the United States plans to move its embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
I think that the Americans moving the embassy to Jerusalem is the right thing to do. I think it's the proper thing to do. And I wish that Canada would follow suit and do the same thing also, move the Canadian embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
Palestinians are furious over the embassy move and U.S. President Donald Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Imad, a shopkeeper in the Arab Bazaar, said Jerusalem is the future capital of a Palestinian state.
I do not expect anything from Donald Trump, so I expect bad things. This is, you know, part of what they are doing against Palestinians. Another step, another thing which will hurt Palestinians.
Jewish pilgrims also flock to Jerusalem to celebrate the start of the week-long biblical holiday of Passover. Rabbis here say the U.S. embassy move reinforces the Passover theme of Jerusalem rebuilt. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Meanwhile, Israeli security forces are bracing for an extended period of protests beginning today along its border with Gaza. Thousands of Palestinians are expected to answer the call to gather in tent cities, demanding a right of return for Palestinian refugees to what is now Israel. The start of the demonstration is symbolically linked to so-called Land Day, when six Israeli Arabs were killed by security forces over a land confiscation in 1976. The protest is expected to last until May 15th, Israel's 70th anniversary, known to Palestinians as the Nakba, or catastrophe. The Israeli military's chief of staff says more than 100 sharpshooters will be deployed and that they have permission to open fire if lives are in danger. But an Israeli cabinet official insisted Israel will try to use minimum force to prevent casualties. Guy Zviv is a Middle East scholar at American University's School of International Service. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty that Palestinian residents of Gaza have much to be concerned about.
As you know, the negotiations, so-called peace process, has been at a standstill since 4 years ago. The parties have just hardened their positions. The Trump administration is not really making a concerted effort to woo the Palestinians. And certainly what did not help was the embassy relocation decision. So this is kind of an opportunity to demonstrate their disaffection, their frustrations, their dire situation in Gaza. They want to really highlight the plight of the Palestinian refugees.
The military chief of staff told an Israeli newspaper that the military would not allow mass infiltration or tolerate damage to the barrier during these protests, which I understand could last weeks.
Keep in mind that over the past week, there have been several Palestinians who have infiltrated the border. They took knives and, in a couple of cases, grenades, and cut through the border. This is something that is of major concern to the IDF that wants to maintain security. The idea is, if you had a few infiltrators already, how are you going to prevent hundreds, potentially thousands, of protesters or demonstrators from infiltrating?
An Israeli cabinet minister speaking on Israel radio said Hamas has avoided direct conflict with Israel since the end of the 2014 Gaza war, but he said pressure Hamas is now feeling from Israel's destruction of some of its network of attack tunnels near the border, coupled with harsh economic conditions in Gaza, are a formula for rising tension.
Well, there's no question that the situation in Gaza is dire. Gaza is an open-air prison. Hamas does bear some responsibility for that because Hamas governs Gaza and has spent much of its resources constructing these terror tunnels. Hamas has redoubled its efforts to rebuild these tunnels, and they clearly do not have peaceful purposes in mind. There is frustration on their part. The economy there is not doing well, and people are not getting electricity every day. So the situation, there's no question the situation is dire. But Hamas has concluded that it is not in its interest to have all-out war with Israel, despite the tensions, because Hamas has a lot to lose, not just Israel. But at the same time, they do have their own internal pressures, and they feel the need to respond to Israel. And of course, Israel feels the need to respond to Hamas whenever there are rockets that land in a southern city. And then, of course, the infiltrators themselves.
Guy Zviv is a Middle East scholar at American University in Washington, D.C. He spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. Welcome back to International Edition, coming to you live from Washington. As news weeks go, this one has come at us fairly fast and hard. So as we close out the week, we thought maybe something a little sweet would be in order. VOA's Steve Norman brings us this profile of a singer and musician said to follow in the tradition of the great Billie Holiday.
Come away with me in the night. Come away with me, and I will write you a song.
Norah Jones is an American singer and songwriter. Billboard magazine named her the top jazz artist of the 2000 to 2009 decade, and she's won 9 Grammy Awards.
And I want to walk with you on a cloudy day in fields where the yellow grass grows knee high. So won't you try to come away with me, and we'll kiss on a mountain top. Come away with me, and I'll never stop loving you.
Norah Jones was born Jitali Norah Shankar on March 30th, 1979, the daughter of renowned Indian sitar player and composer Ravi Shankar and American concert producer Sue Jones. She launched her solo career in 2002 with the release of Come Away With Me, a commercially successful and critically acclaimed album that was a fusion of jazz with country music and pop. After her parents divorced in 1986, Norah Jones moved to the U.S. state of Texas with her mother, and that's where she grew up. Then headed to New York, where the songs she wrote and sang became bestsellers, songs like Chasing Pirates. Jones has collaborated with some of the best songwriters in the business, including Jesse Harris. His song, Don't Know Why, became the second single by Jones from her debut studio album. It peaked at number 30 on the Billboard Hot 100 and was a critical success.
Left you by the house of fun. I don't know why I didn't come. I don't know why I didn't come.
After a period of estrangement from her father, Ravi Shankar, Jones traveled to India to spend time with him and wrote some of the material she plays even today on her many tours. Ravi Shankar died in 2012. And in 2014, Nora Jones had her first child with her musician husband, who she says wishes to remain anonymous. They had a second child in 2016. Jones is known for being extremely private about her personal life, preferring to spend time with family and simply writing and singing songs.
Great Nora Jones, brought to us by VOA's Steve Norman. Well, many thanks for joining us here on International Edition this week. Latest world news is straight ahead. I hope you'll stay tuned for that. For all of us here in Studio 23, Director Patrice Norman, Engineer Nick Ivanoff, I'm Doug Bernard. Have yourself a great weekend. And now, more Nora Jones.
Something has to make you run. I don't know why I didn't.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Donald Trump has acted to address Chinese policies and practices that are harming American innovation. The president announced that the United States will consider adding 25% additional tariffs on certain products that are supported by Chinese industrial policies that unfairly disadvantage U.S. companies, including aerospace, information communication technology, and machinery. In addition, the U.S. trade representative will confront China's discriminatory technology licensing practices through a World Trade Organization dispute proceeding. And the Department of Treasury will propose restrictions on investment by China in sensitive U.S. technology sectors. These proposed steps are the result of an investigation into Chinese policies and practices related to technology transfer, intellectual property, and innovation. The U.S. Trade Representative, or USTR, led the investigation under Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974, which gives the USTR authority, subject to presidential direction, to address unfair trade practices that burden U.S. commerce. This was the first such investigation since 2013. It concluded that China uses foreign ownership restrictions, such as joint venture requirements and administrative review and licensing processes, to force or pressure U.S. companies to transfer technology to Chinese entities. China requires foreign companies that seek to access their new energy vehicles market to transfer core technologies and disclose development and manufacturing technology for the entire vehicle. The investigation concluded that China often forces U.S. companies seeking to license technologies to Chinese entities to do so on non-market-based terms. China imposes contractual restrictions on the licensing of intellectual property and foreign technology into their country.